Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Today's Football Times with me, Aidan Williams. Today we'll be discussing various issues around the modern Premier League and its fixation with money, be that pay-per-view, dubious owners, oligarchs, oil states, super agents, and much, much more. We've got some great guests as usual, of course. And first up is one of our newer writers at These Football Times. He's an author too, with a couple of great sports books in his repertoire. But it's a debut appearance on Today's Football Times for Stephen Bell. Welcome, Stephen.
Thanks, Aidan. Great to be here.
Good stuff. And also here tonight is our own super agent in Spain, Gary Thacker. How's it, Gary?
Evening. Yeah, Aidan. Thanks for having me on again. It's always a great chat on Today's Football Times to talk about the more current stuff that we don't always get a chance to discuss on the other pod. So delighted to be back again.
Good stuff. And finally, our Scottish oligarch is with us again today, Lewis Henderson. Welcome back to the pod.
Thanks for having me, and very glad that some of the things we were saying in the last Today's Football Times about Scotland maybe not qualifying, I'm glad that has not been true and we qualified. So very happy with that.
Yes, the first tournament in your life that you're actually going to be aware of. Good stuff for you.
Can I just say, guys, before we go further, I thought I cursed Scotland when we did the pod before about Scottish prospects, and I said, you know, they'll be lead to the last minute and it'll be a last minute goal and they'll get denied. I thought, I can't believe it's going to happen as well. But, you know, well done the Scots, top guys to get through. Brilliant stuff.
The Scots are good at penalties. The Scots are very good at penalties, which is a handy knack to have in these situations.
Indeed.
But before we get into the financial woes of the modern game, we definitely need to talk a little bit about news from the other week and the death of the great Diego Armando Maradona. And to many, he was simply the greatest footballer ever to have graced the game. He was an icon of a nation, transcending the game to become embedded in the very culture and identity of Argentina, as well as being an icon to many of the clubs he played at, none more so than Napoli, of course. He's a real rags to riches story, I guess, for the man himself. Hugely, hugely gifted with such sublime talent with the ball beyond the likes that we've seen with pretty much anyone else. I mean, Gary, what a true legend and a great loss to football and Argentina in particular. I mean, what do you recall the most from his glittering career? When you close your eyes and think of Maradona, what do you see?
I guess 4 minutes of England and Argentina in the World Cup, and you know, it's the sort of the sublime goal, and then the hand of God goal. And I think there's something. Maradona surpasses superstardom in football because he's got something else. He's got something that's extra, and also something that's a little bit detracting from him as well. He's one of those flawed geniuses like Alex Higgins was at snooker, or George Best in football as well. Had so many weaknesses that made him, his talent made him above us, but his weaknesses made him part of us as well. So I think, you know, you see players like Messi, Ronaldo, Cristiano Ronaldo these days, and they'll be lauded as great players, but I don't think they'll ever be as loved as Maradona is in Argentina. And as you mentioned, in Napoli as well. So, you know, I think that's, I'll remember him as a genius, but a flawed genius. But that doesn't make him worse. It actually almost elevates him a little bit farther because he showed us what we could all do. You know, we've all got weaknesses, but, you know, such sublime, sublime talent.
Yeah, absolutely so. I mean, there were a few comments in this country, sadly, I guess, mentioning the word cheat, which is rather small-minded, of course. Some can't seem to get over their narrow view and fully appreciate what an incredible talent he had. His was a World Cup story that it spanned four tournaments, but could easily have been five, as he was so nearly a part of the 1978 squad. He'd played for Argentina a little bit prior to that, but he was only 17 at the time, just a little bit too young, unfortunately. But it went all the way through to a bit of an ignominious end in 1994. But we've got a bit of a range of ages on this pod today, and what I'm quite interested in is how that might give each of us a slightly different perspective on Maradona. So, Gary, you've obviously seen his whole career play out while you were an adult. for me, his most explosive and celebrated years were my formative years of football watching, you know, when my eyes were being opened to great international talents through the prism of a World Cup. Stephen, I think I'm right in your saying your football consciousness will have been towards the end of his career rather than his prime. And for Lewis, obviously, it's the whole thing was before you were even born, which just makes us all feel a bit old. Stephen, coming to you first, having heard Gary and I eulogise a little bit at his greatness, do you have the same perspective given the part of his career that you have witnessed?
I do now, but as you say, it's a generational thing with anything like this. And my footballing love really started at USA 94 when he had one of his more infamous moments, you know, running towards the camera, screaming into it, wide-eyed, wide-mouthed. And I remember well, even though I was only, 9 years old, something like that, 8 years old, maybe. I remember it well. My dad almost introduced me to Maradona in that environment. You know, you're just seen a crazy person celebrating a goal. And he is actually a crazy person. You know, this is what he did to England 8 years ago. And so that was sort of my introduction to Maradona. Obviously, he told me what a fantastic player he was. But I'd never actually seen that firsthand. And then what you got then as I was getting older, still not really seeing many clips, obviously well before the YouTube generation, you just knew as a football obsessive, you knew that Maradona was in that list of all-time greats without me actually knowing how or why. I knew he'd won the World Cup with Argentina. I knew he'd helped Napoli almost single-handedly become a force in Italy, which was the strongest league at the time. But I couldn't actually apply my own sort of knowledge to it. It was just something that I knew via osmosis or something, I don't know. And so what you had then was, as I started getting sort of tabloid aware, probably in the early 2000s, after he'd long retired, there were a period where, I mean, he was overweight for most of his, beyond his playing career, but there were a period, I don't know if you remember, when he was absolutely ginormous. And the media just portrayed him as this complete joke figure. You know, Diego Fatter Donna might be the headline, you know, with Donna spelt like Donna Kebab. And you were almost just ridiculed beyond belief in this country. And now knowing why, and especially after as you mentioned, Aidan, the awful, despicable headlines that we saw on the Red Tops the day after his death, I think it was just a 30-year vendetta against him because of the hand of God. I do believe that. And this went on for me until... So if somebody had asked me who my favourite, I thought the best players of all time were, it would have, of course, been on the list. But without me truly knowing why that all changed, it'll only been 7 or 8 months ago when the fantastic documentary movie by Asif Kapadia came out. That he probably went on from fourth or fifth in my all-time list, straight into number one after watching that hour-and-a-half documentary movie. Every type of goal, the vision, speed, power in such a small body, yeah, blew me away. And it also made me fully achieve just what he achieved with, fully appreciate just what he achieved with what were pretty average sides, in truth, to drag them the way that he did. The term unplayable gets banded around quite a bit in football. I think from what I've seen now and what I know, he was truly, truly unplayable, and it wouldn't have mattered if he were playing with a Sunday league side. I think he'd have won just as many trophies because it was just that dynamic.
It's interesting you say about the type of clubs he was at, Stephen, because, you know, the one club he probably isn't the best remembered at is Barcelona, the biggest club he was a part of, arguably, and it just didn't suit him. He needed to be battling the odds, I think, and that was where he was at most at home. And if there wasn't a battle to be fought, he would create one. I mean, that's probably a lot of his Argentina story was creating those enemies that he could battle against, that he needed to get the very best out of himself, I think. I mean, he'll remembered well in Scotland, Lewis, I'm sure, for both of his goals in a certain quarter-final in 1986. But they displayed both sides of his character and indeed that of Argentinian football. But on that similar generational point, Lewis, I mean, your perspective, again, this is he didn't catch any of his career like Stephen has, and his perception of obviously changed with more recent events. But is your view any different given that all of it happened before you were born?
So for me, it's like, as you said, I never watched Maradona during his career. So for me, the reason he sticks out for me so much is because of the sort of cultural impact he's had since, and specific, like, what the way he's regarded in Naples is one of the most, for me, is one of the most fascinating things you can see in football, really. When you look at the sort of social political landscape of Italy when he joined Napoli, there was such a divide between sort of north and central Italy and southern Italy, where Naples is, of course. And a southern Italian side had never won the Serie A. So it was a case of Juve, the Milans and Roma. And it's like you're saying, the underdog story, it's like he picked Napoli up from the scruff of their neck and took them to win a UEFA Cup, two league titles, and I believe that's the only two league titles that Napoli have won to this day. And you look at Naples now, I've not had the pleasure of being myself, but they've renamed the stadium after him, they've retired the number 10, and you can't go around the street corner without there being a mural to Maradona. And I think that speaks volumes to how much he's adored by that club. And personally, I don't think I've seen anything quite like it in football, and it's one of the most remarkable things I've seen. So from that respect, I hold him as one of the finest players in football, just for the cultural impact he's had there, like in Naples.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Gary, you want to come back in on El Diego?
Just going back to the hand of God thing, and you know, at the time, you know, he was castigated, and as the guys have mentioned, that has been dragged on for quite a while. But we're talking best part of 36 years ago now. And, you know, I think it's time to get a little bit more mature about it. And, you know, there isn't a single England player on the park that would not have done exactly the same thing if they could have got away with it. So, you know, it's okay. And at the time, I'm sure, you know, emotions were thinking, oh, it's terrible, it's cheap. But, you know, so is kicking him up in the air, which happened for most of, not only that game, but most of the tournaments. And two wrongs don't make a right. But as I say, we can't be too po-faced about it and say, you know, oh, England wouldn't have done that because, you know, if they didn't, the films, because, you know, they would have done. And Gary Lineker said as much, he's speaking to other people there. And I did a radio thing with Alvin Martin a few years ago, two, 3 years ago now, and he was on the bench and we were talking about it. And he said, you know, any England player would have done the same. And if they didn't, they'd have a right cushion from the teammates. So let's not be powerfaced about it. Let's recognise, you know, it was a little bit cheeky, but there you go.
And let's be honest, Terry Fenwick elbowed him in the face and could have been sent off a couple of times in that game, and others too. So, you know, England were no angels in that match, were they?
No, two wrongs don't make a right. But, you know, as I say, it's, you know, it's England, any England player would have done exactly the same thing. And I'm sure the millions, tens of millions of people in England watching the game as well would have done the same.
Yeah, I just think also another reason why we all have this deep affection for him, it ties in perfectly with what we're about to talk about for the majority of this podcast, and that's that there'll never be another Maradona, there'll never be probably another George Best or maybe Eric Cantona, these sort of unique personalities, these flawed geniuses, they wouldn't be allowed to exist in today's game. The players and the managers are so PR trained that they'd either get driven out of the game or they'd get that personality beaten out of them. And I think that's a real shame in terms of the passion and the on-the-pitch spectacle that we see and that, for me, I miss from the sort of when I first got into football, especially in the mid to late 90s. I think the game's somewhat unrecognisable from that. And I think that where Maradona was an extreme, George Best was an extreme, I think we've slowly drifted away from having them personalities where they're more like robots now, which is what we're going to go on to talk about largely. So, yeah, I think Maradona is sort of the last bastion of that type of unique, flawed genius within the game.
certainly free-spirited, isn't he? Those of our listeners who follow us on Twitter will know that there's already plans afoot for a Maradona magazine, getting the treatment from our print editions, and there'll be many, maybe even some more podcasts going into a bit of extra depth on the great man, so keep an eye out for all of that. It's all in the works so far. We also lost Ray Clements recently too. And Gary, I guess you're the only one of us here who's actually seen him, much of his career play out. mentioning just before we started, to me, I remember him most as a Tottenham player rather than a Liverpool one. That's just the age I am. Quick word from you on Clements. I mean, one of the finest goalkeepers in the world, even though he didn't quite get the international recognition he deserved.
Extraordinary goalkeeper and almost one of a kind as well. The way he sort of kept goal was not like the traditional goalkeeper in so many ways. But yeah, I did well at Tottenham after being almost pensioned off at Liverpool, but considered too old. And then went to Tottenham and got and kicked off another career. And it was unfortunate to be around at the same time as Shilton. And I remember Ron Greenwood, for example, when he was England manager, rotated the goalkeepers. I mean, for crazy reason, they'd selected his number one. And if Shilton hadn't been there, Clements would have had 150, 160 caps, no danger.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's the misfortune of timing. I mean, that happens, there's various times, aren't there? Anyone who was a number 10 understudy to Maradona was never going to get very far. I think there was Borghi, I think, was one of the greats of that era in Argentina, and he never got a look in. Clements is very much the same. You know, he had little stints, didn't he? But
yeah.
Never quite as many caps as Shilton, unfortunately, even though at times he was the better player, I'm quite sure. Lewis, I know you've been doing a bit of research into someone you never heard of really that much before. Sorry, heard of, but not known about. I should correct myself too, so go for it. Here's your chance.
So it's just, it's much that Gary was saying, really, in terms of he was sandwiched in between an era of Gordon Banks and Peter Shilton, and it's just a case of the fact, I wrote it down, 61 caps he managed to get in that time speaks volumes, because as someone who wasn't quite around during those two goalkeepers either, like you go back, you watch highlights, I've watched highlights of Clements today, and I've seen Shilton and Banks in the past, and it is the culture of a player and the impact they have on a club is just something that really fascinates me. And I think it must have been a month before Clements passed away. There was a big mural done just outside Anfield. It's just along from Anfield of Ray Clements. I think it was done in October. And again, I think that just speaks volumes in terms of how influential a keeper he was. I've been reading things from Liverpool fans who said he's the greatest keeper they've ever had. And it's just, it speaks volumes of the man that they've dedicated a mural to near Anfield, I would say.
Absolutely so. So yeah, another great loss. I mean, it seems to be a regular feature now on these pods that we're talking about iconic players of the past who've passed on, but they certainly all deserve their recognition. Okay, well, we'll move on now though to what Stephen here described when suggesting this topic as the soulless financial vacuum that the modern game has become. Perfect phrase there, I think. I mean, we'll get into some of the themes around this shortly, but first of all, Stephen, for you, is it a case of the constant erosion of what used to be so good in your mind? I guess the era you grew up in when you first became aware of football and the joy of it, the current game moved so far away from that in your mind, I guess, from what it used to be. Is that to do with just the money, do you think, or is it just a wider perception of, you know, getting older and things like that that change in your mind?
Yeah, you're probably right there. I think every football fan probably has a nostalgic view on their own first sort of years falling in love with the game. But it has changed so much, it really has. And I mean, I'm a lefty liberal snowflake. You know, the last thing that I ever want to do is go down the route of blame the foreigners. But I do think that we've lost some passion in the going down the mercenary route. I think that's had a lot to do with it, but more so than the foreign influence on the pitch, which I think is good so long as it's used to improve the standard of the game on the pitch and improve player standards because they're training with better players. I think that's amazing. That's wonderful. I think the foreign influence off the pitch is a larger negative influence in that, as you mentioned before, we're getting oligarchs, even state-run conglomerates just wanting to buy these sporting establishments as playthings, it appears. And the fans are so secondary in the thoughts that it really, really does show out on the pitch. And yeah, it does just seem to have changed so much. When I first got into football, I think you'd probably got your foreign influence on the pitch was a sprinkling of sort of stardust that you wanted to see. You know, your Cantona, your Gianfranco Zola, your David Ginolas. It was like your club had gone and spent this money on this amazingly talented player to come to these shores and improve the squad, improve the team, because they literally couldn't find a player of that standard here. They didn't have a player of that standard in the squad to do that particular job. Now it just feels like we've abandoned the sort of loyalty to the local community players, to the youth players, to the point where they're not getting a look in and they're just farmed out on loan. They're then used as pawns, I think, in some kind of chess game that they're playing with what certain clubs wanting to play, where they just hold on to the talent because they're scared of letting it go and then them flourishing and coming back to bite them. And yeah, I just think it's changed so much in them ways that it's really had a negative effect actually on the field spectacle, which is when you start to notice it. I mean, the stadiums all being named after, you know, largely betting companies or airlines, you know, there's just no soul to it, is there? You know, imagine if, you know, Manchester United in the mid-90s and late-90s was sponsored by Sharp ViewCam, but imagine if the Theatre of Dreams Old Trafford had been called the Sharp ViewCam Stadium. You know, it just wouldn't have had the same romance to it, would it? But that's the way it's going. It's whoever's got the most money, whoever's willing to put the hand deepest into those big pockets, gets their own way, is the way that I think football's gone now.
Don't get me started on the stadium name, Stephen. I absolutely despise it, as you say. You know, the Anfield, Old Trafford, St James's Park in my case, Stamford Bridge, Gary, you've still got one, thankfully. But, you know, Emirates, Etihad, all of this, oh, I just despise it. I absolutely despise it. It's just...
Bet365.
Well, yeah, that's the real cherry on the cake, that one, isn't it? But in recent events, I guess after a month now that's seen the end, at least for now anyway, of the Premier League short-lived pay-per-view TV, which hasn't gone well, shall we say. Lewis, this controversial move, it seemed to completely misread their audience, didn't it? I mean, it's impacted arguably more on fans from outside the Big Six who were less frequently on the regular TV slots anyway. Has it felt a bit like the straw that's broke the camel's back? I mean, they've milked the fans' loyalty for years, of course, and it's always seemed as though the expectation is that fans will just keep paying and paying. Have we reached a limit, Lewis, do you think, or is it solely the unique circumstances at the moment that caused this particular backlash?
I'd like to think it was the final straw, but I think circumstances played a lot into it in terms of the situation we're in at the moment. People are so limited into what they can do and are more likely to vent their frustrations. At least that's my opinion on it. And rightly so in this case. I mean, top flight football, if we actually remember back to when it was originally discussed coming back, it was only meant to sort of restart on the condition that all matches were shown live on TV. Now, I'm sure BT Sport and Sky Sports would say, but we are showing it on TV. But it's not the same as hiding it behind a box office, a premium as it is, in their already sort of extortionate subscription package that fans will be paying for anyway. So, and essentially what made it worse for me was that, like, the already extortionate subscriptions people were paying, they were trying to justify paying extra for ultimately their product, which is the Premier League, which was actually a watered-down version of what it normally is, because the product wasn't as good as it has been because there was no crowd. Some of the like footballers, people who come to watch, are injured because of the hectic schedule we'll be discussing in a while, I'm sure. And I think it was an absolutely... I was really impressed by the fans of certain clubs, such as your club, Aidan Newcastle, that rather than paying that ridiculous fee for that ridiculous product, they went and they put their money towards food banks. I think it was 19,000 that Newcastle fans raised. And I know Leeds and Aston Villa did a similar thing. It was a bit of a bright spark to come out of what was otherwise a horrendous misreading of the situation by the governing bodies.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the earliest pay-per-view games. Newcastle, Manchester United, it was one of the first, at least on the first weekend of it. And yeah, it was very good for the donations to the food banks of Newcastle, let's say, and not so good for the TV companies. I mean, the audience numbers have been incredibly low, not just on that game, on a huge number of the games. So perhaps that might keep any such plans on the back burner for now. You mentioned the protests and the unwittingly... cause additional charitable donations instead. I mean, how would this be perceived in other countries? I mean, Gary, is this something that is part of the TV package in Spain? I know it's slightly different there. It's not the sort of collective agreement necessarily, because Barcelona and Madrid have a bit of a greater power and a greater share than would be the case here for the top few clubs. But is this something that's being attempted or would be attempted over there as well?
Well, over here it's very different. There's no tradition, no real tradition of playing all the games at 3 o'clock on a Saturday. For as long as I can remember, basically the games are played consecutively. So there's often one on a Friday evening, four on a Saturday, running from sort of like 2 o'clock till 9 o'clock in the evening. Same on Sunday, and then sometimes one on Monday as well. But the package you get over here, so I've got Movistar is the package I've got over here. On Movistar, I get all of the La Liga games, as I've just described. I get the Bundesliga, and I get Serie A as well. And I pay a lot less than I used to pay for Sky. That's for damn sure. So what we get here for the money is a lot better than the UK. But as I say, all the games are played consecutively, and there's always been a lot of angst among fans when they get sort of the Friday night 8:30, 9 o'clock fixture on a Friday evening. And I know at the start of last season, talking to a guy who lives in Bilbao, and Athletic Club supporter, and they had three of their first four games on a Friday evening. And they were saying, it's unfair. And Barcelona and Real Madrid tend not to have those slots, and that's true, they don't. But as I say, it is slightly different, and it's different history over here. I would just say one thing, I'm happy to sort of line myself up alongside Stephen. I'm also a very liberal lefty as well. But I think we can't be too naive about these things. Money has always, as long as I can remember, and well before that, been a strong factor in football in the UK. In England especially, I remember reading about back in the sort of 30s, Sunderland were called the Bank of England club because they were the richest club. And the money might have come from somewhere different, but money was still a big factor. And, going on through the 50s and 60s and 70s, it was always the same applied. Man United were always the richest club. So money's always been a factor in there. And yes, it has become, the old phrase, money doesn't speak, it shouts. And sometimes, we look at football, he doesn't shout, he bloody screams. Screams blue murder, and, there's a lot of things going on, a little bit unsavoury. And certainly, I'd agree with what the guy said about the pay-per-view. It was a terrible indictment. We've got people who are paying for Sky subscriptions or BT subscriptions already and have to pay again. I mean, that's just crazy because you're paying already. And, and apparently there was, I don't know if this is true, but I assume it must be, there were people who've got season tickets to go to certain clubs, be Liverpool, Man United, or whoever, and then were asked to pay again to watch the game on the TV. And, that does seem like it's squeezing every last ounce out of the public purse.
Yeah, and that's true. I mean, as part of lockdown one, I think season ticket holders were given sort of free passes to access certain TV feeds, weren't they? But they certainly were at Newcastle anyway. I don't know whether it was across the board, but it might well have been. But it definitely not the case of what they're doing now. But I guess the TV company's power knows no bounds, doesn't it? You talk there about there's always been money influencing the game, and there has. But I guess the growth of that, it's the curve anyway, has shot up over the last 2 decades or 2.5 decades, I guess, hasn't it? And the influence is just getting more and more.
Of course it has, yeah, you're right. But even now, looking back, you know, in when I said about Sunderland being the Bank of England club, other clubs then were, this is ridiculous, this is unfair. You know, money's distorting the balance of the game then. And it is, and it was, and it is more now. But the sad thing is, it's probably not looking bad now, it's going to be in the future, because football clubs aren't run as football clubs anymore, they're businesses. And with a very, very few exceptions, people who buy football clubs do it to make money. Brass is important, not silverware. The metal they're interested in is brass, not silver.
And I guess the influence of TV isn't just over the money. They influence the league schedule as well, to some extent, don't they? I mean, it's not really the entire control of the league itself anymore. Instead, it's at the whim of the TV companies. So I guess this is less applicable right now in the current situation, but the impact on the match-going fan seems almost an irrelevance at times. At the moment, fixtures can be changed at times when people can't get a train home to the other end of the country, or changed so late that plans have to be changed.
Of course.
Are fans simply an afterthought now?
You're right, but in fairness, the league, the Premier League, you know, aren't the people who sold that right. It was the clubs who sold that right. So it's the clubs who have that little regard. And, you know, I think Jurgen Klopp is so good in so many ways. But, you know, when you're saying, oh, it's not fair because we have to play a Champions League and then half past 12 on a Saturday, well, you know, your club, go and have a word with the guys who sold that right away. You know, it's not the TV company's fault. They said, here's this, we will give you this much money for this much product. And the club said yes. They've got to say yes. They've been gun to the head. They did it for the money. So, Jurgen, don't complain to BT. Complain to your directors. They're the guys who signed the deal.
Yeah, Stephen, come to you on that, because Solskjaer has had a few things to say about that in terms of the scheduling as well. As we say, I guess you can understand the short turnaround of the impact it has. But as Gary says, you're accepting the golden coin, if you like. You're accepting the fact that you want to be in Champions League and the Premier League, and you want to compete in both. Is this the price that the clubs have to pay for accepting the money? Essentially, if they want to have the financial muscle to attract the players they do, is this the payoff that they just have to accept?
Yeah, I think the more I fully accept what Gary's saying about the fact that the richest clubs have always had an on the field advantage. I think the problem is, and by the way, I actually think in recent years the money's gone so ludicrously high within the Premier League, and the TV enormous amounts of money being spread out quite evenly among the Premier League clubs has actually improved the competition in terms of selling. Clubs are no longer as quick to sell. They hold on to players. They get the full market price now because they don't feel bullied into selling anymore. And we see teams like Tottenham now, Harry Kane staying there. He knows he's going to get paid the big bucks. He knows he doesn't have to go searching for them anymore. And we see Tottenham now flourishing at the top of the league. I do think that it's had a positive effect in that way. I believe that the more zeros are on the end of them TV contracts, though, it just attracts the wrong kind of owners to clubs, which I think has been very punishing to the game, and especially certain clubs within the game. And again, just going back to a point I made earlier, I think that the clubs have gone so far away from the community, they're now just a huge business that happens to be based in an area. I think one particular example of that was Liverpool, when they furloughed the staff. You know, it's such a proud socialist heritage. The club and the fans sort of wear on the chest as a badge of honour. Again, the American owners probably have no idea about that. They don't understand it. And their decision to furlough the staff, which they later reversed, were yet another sign of the clubs having gone too far away from the fans, too far away from the heritage, and making bad decisions on that behalf and almost embarrassing the club and the fans. So, I don't know. It'll never stop. I know. I think the money's there to stay. I think the bad owners are there to stay. I think the problem is with the Premier League and the FA in terms of clamping down on that and showing some pride, I think, in who these owners are, where the money's coming from. And if that means going back to a situation where we have less TV games and there's more 3 o'clock kickoffs and some of the owners don't like that and take the money back home with them, I personally don't think that'd be a bad thing. I can't see it happening because money will rule the situation. But yeah, I do think I've been thinking about a lot recently as to where this sort of, where the balance tipped, where the scales tipped in the favour of the money instead of the quality of the on-pitch product and the fans, ultimately. I think it's gone away from the fans. It's certainly the paying customer, the family who relied on going to the 3 o'clock kickoff because it was so perfect for them to fit into their weekend routine after doing the full week at work and the children at school. That's been completely disregarded now. And yeah, I don't know where we'll go from here, but that's what we're here to discuss.
Well, in terms of the fans then, Lewis, I mean, you mentioned a little bit there in terms of the clubs and what they have to accept and a bit of the fans' perspective. And they are kind of insignificant when it comes to the big money and the TV contracts and all of that. But, you know, when a club isn't doing well, the fans, all they ever want is spend more money, buy this guy, buy that guy. Do fans therefore lose the right? Right probably isn't the right word, of course. I mean, it is their club after all. But do they lose a little bit of the impact of their message because they're constantly demanding more spending, more spending, more spending? That therefore they are also the afterthought because of the big money that's coming into the game. Is that something that fans have to learn to accept?
I feel like the attitude that fans have in that regard of spend, is a consequence of where the league has gone. It's almost like a chicken and the egg. Like, what came first? Was it fans' demands, or was it this monetization of the game to such an extreme capacity almost? And I completely agree with the points that Stephen and Gary have made. It's just the way I sort of look at it now. If you look at I know things we're going to touch on sort of Project Big Picture and even like European Super League, it's very much Americanization of football. It's a point that Stephen made a while ago. Football, and this was in the Maradona segment, football is just not what it was anymore. And the way I look at it, as someone who does watch a fair bit of NBA, for example, it's very much going down that route. And if football, and if the owners and that could have their way, they absolutely would have no relegations for the top six. You can only see with the things they tried, the rules and legislation they tried to bring in with Project Big Picture, you can see exactly what they want. And I can understand the frustration of fans to say spend more and we've got these incredibly rich owners so they should be doing this, but it's almost a case of be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, we'll get into the whole owners thing in a second. I just got one other sort of player related thing, if I can get political for a moment, and Gary, you're the guy to come to when it comes to political football. recent regulations around signing foreign players post-Brexit have shown that clubs will be less able to hoover up young foreign talent than they are now. You're not going to be able to sign anyone under 18 from abroad, as has been the case with Fabregas, I guess, is a prominent example. And all other foreign signings will have to earn work permits on a points basis. So I guess while this won't affect the high-caliber players at all, they'll still be... they're not going to struggle for a work permit, but will it potentially reduce the international appeal of the league in any way, do you think? Or and as a result of that, therefore reduce how much the TV deal might be worth internationally?
I guess theoretically you have to say yes. In real terms, I think that the answer is probably less clear. I think we need to be sort of realistic. Firstly, you know, the Premier League is not the top league in Europe. Spain is by far the best players in the world playing Spain and Italy. Ronaldo had a short time in England before moving. Messi's never played in England. Neymar's never played in England. Mbappe's never played in England. And you can't see it happening either. The greatest players in the world don't play in the Premier League. So I think we need to keep a little perspective on that anyway. The other thing is, yeah, as the way things look at the moment, and that's an awfully big caveat, it may be more complicated, but that's been said in the past. And I'm sure there are ways around these things. And, you know, if we're looking at a situation where more young English talent gets a chance to shine, I'm all for it. And, you know, that would be fantastic. I'm sort of less sanguine about, obviously more sanguine about whether that's actually going to be the case. You know, I mean, it's interesting, you know, when, I mean, just using Markle, for example, last season when we had the transfer ban, Lampard played, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 kids at one time who'd come through the academy. And, you know, we're seeing the benefit of that now. We've got Reece James, who looks exceptional, generational talent, Mason Mount, Callum Hudson-Odoi, Tanner Abraham, and these are all playing regular first team football who came through the academy. So if that happens, you know, that would be great. But I'm less than totally convinced that that will be the case.
So let's come to the ownership issue now. And this is obviously core to the whole thing. I mean, this is perhaps where the change in the game is the most stark. We're used to see wealthy local businessmen in control of most football clubs. Now it's the realm of the international super wealthy, and they've got an altogether different perspective to fans. And as you mentioned there, it's all about making money. We've seen Russian oligarchs, American venture capitalists, all rich states, and so on. Each new takeover seems to push the boat out a little bit further. The wealth goes up every single time. And Gary, I'm going to come to you again first on this, because I guess the most prominent change in this direction was arguably Roman Abramovich's arrival at Chelsea. I think that was about 2004, if I'm correct there. And obviously his reign has brought incredible success to Chelsea. But is it seen as entirely a positive by Chelsea fans?
Yes. Yes,
purely on that success, the club, or
I think not purely on that success, but certainly it gave people, or I mean, you know, and a lot of Chelsea fans who are sort of 30, 40 years younger than me, you know, will have been said, you know, oh, you've only been a Chelsea fan since the money came. Well, I've been a Chelsea fan since 1961, so you know, anybody chucking that one at me, kiss my Astrakhan coat. But you know, I think, and I'm going to say this, aren't I? And I accept people will say, oh, well, of course you're going to say that. But I think Roman is different in as much as nobody could say that Roman Abramovich bought that club to make money, because all it's done is costing money. And, you know, so I think his reason for buying that club and the way he is regarded as Chelsea owner, as a football club owner, is different. I'm not saying it's better, and people might say, you know, you're trying to sugarcoat. I'm not. It's different than the most of the venture capitalists that you mentioned, and who have bought clubs to make money. Roman didn't bought that club to make money. He's bought that club to, I suppose, to enjoy the success he can give there, he can produce there. And it's also worth mentioning, and Stephen mentioned earlier about you know, the local community. Roman was the first football, Chelsea was the first football club to, Roman put the Chelsea Hotel, which adjoins the ground, free for all NHS staff to stay in there when they were at sort of quarantine away from them, from their families, self-isolate away from their families. And, you know, a lot of other clubs, Chelsea never did try to furlough their team either. And unlike Arsenal, they didn't sack the mascot to save 50 or 60 quid a week and then lavish, I don't know, tens of thousands of pounds on new players' wages, which was always a baffling one for me. So I think, you know, I mean, I think, A, Chelsea are a lot different to a lot of other clubs. And some people might say, well, they're just different in a bad way. And that's fine, guys. I mean, everybody's allowed their opinion. But I think Roman's influence at Chelsea has been a lot better than a lot of people perhaps give me credit for.
Yeah, that's a fair distinction to make, I think. I guess if we're talking about how it's changed, though, his arrival maybe skewed things towards financial might. I'm not saying that's a negative in any way, Gary. I mean, obviously, you're right, he has been in it just to try and get success. to enjoy his money and do that by giving Chelsea the means to push on and gain great success. Less popular, though, I guess. Stephen, coming to you, the Glazers at Manchester United. Their arrivals prompted some to turn their backs on the club altogether. FC United obviously came about at that time, and various other people will have just gone off to other things. It sees huge amounts of revenue being taken out of the club. This is completely in contrast, as Gary was saying there, to what Abramovich has been doing at Chelsea. This to pay off the loans that they took out to buy it, and obviously they're raking in the money in the meantime. So has their ownership affected the way you feel about your club?
I don't know if it's their ownership or that being a symptomatic problem within the modern game. As Gary said, I absolutely agree. You cannot compare the Glazers' ownership of Manchester United with Abramovich's ownership of Chelsea. It's all very much the foreign ownership model, which is all kind of put under one umbrella. But as Gary said, Abramovich just wanted to bring success. Whether that was a selfish point of view, you know, the stories about him just wanting to see that Champions League trophy on the end of his yacht, that kind of thing. But that's fair enough. The fans still loved it. The players formed a fantastic team. Jose Mourinho were brought to the league. That was fantastic. It brought new entertainment value for our manager. What the Glazers have done is... It's almost money laundering, isn't it? You know, it's using this big financial juggernaut that is Manchester United to create wealth and put it elsewhere within their empire. But the problem is, do we really talk about it anymore? It were a big deal at the time, a decade ago. Do we talk about it anymore? No, it's become accepted. It's become the norm. That has got a lot to do with Manchester United now being, by their standards, very average and in obscurity. The problem is with that is that every time the fans kick up a stink, they go and spend a fortune on a player to almost keep them happy, but they do it in the wrong way because they've got the wrong management structure there. I think they've got the wrong management structure there because Ed Woodward is... a bit of a puppet for the Glazers. I think if they had somebody in that role that was stronger, they would be banging on the door more. They would be demanding more money at the appropriate times rather than when it suited the Glazers. I think it's from the Glazers down why Manchester United find themselves in that obscurity. Very different to the Abramovich model, no doubt about it. And then you've got the Manchester City model, which is sort of in between. You know, they've got more money than they could possibly ever spend, them at more money in interest than they could ever spend on a football club. So at that point, money literally becomes inconsequential to them, the money that they're going to spend on that football club. And where it comes from, I think it has grated on quite a lot of Manchester City fans. I do think that they feel... the club isn't as romantic as it otherwise could be if they'd got that success from their struggles in a more authentic way, for want of a better word. And I think that's why you still see... I mean, who would have thought if somebody had told Man City fans 20 years ago that they'd have this success, they'd be in the Champions League and with a chance of winning the Champions League, they'd be winning Premier Leagues. But you'll still have your stadium could still be, obviously... taking COVID into account before we had empty stadiums anyway, you're going to have a lot of empty seats at your biggest matches. They wouldn't have believed you. Them empty seats are symptomatic of the fact that the sporting romance in Manchester City's success isn't there. There's still sporting success, but it hasn't got that romantic feel that I think they thought they always would have if and when they came back to the forefront of the game. So that's three different foreign ownership models that we've just discussed, or I've just discussed. I think every one of them are very different. I was just going to say they've all got the pros and cons, but I don't think the Glazers at Manchester United has got any pros, to be honest. But you can just see why it attracts. It's different incentives for different foreign owners to come into the game. I'm not sure that any of them that we've discussed have been great for the game. Abramovich has been great for Chelsea, without a doubt. But long term, I don't know where that leads to. You know, I'm guessing at some point we're going to discuss the proposed or failed Newcastle takeover, which was possibly going to be even one step further than the Man City thing. And yeah, you just at that stage, you don't know where it ends. And I think that's the problem for a lot of fans.
Well, yes, you mentioned the Saudi takeover of Newcastle. I mean, that's obviously something I've got a bit of a vested interest in. It's been, I don't know, an incredible saga up here, how that one's played out. I think the worst thing about it all, I mean, I guess a majority of fans, well, I don't want to say a majority, a number of fans will just accept whatever because they want their club to succeed and they will happily ignore whatever other issues come with it. Others will take umbrage at it and will protest and complain. To me, I think the biggest issue with that takeover, mooted takeover anyway, was that what seems to have killed it wasn't human rights. It wasn't anything else about the Saudi regime. It wasn't what they're doing in Yemen or anything like that. It was TV piracy. That's what the biggest issue was to the Premier League. They didn't end up officially denying the ownership, denying the transfer. They just held out and held out and held out until that more or less became an inevitability, which, I don't know, it might have been easier if they just come out and said so from the start, and then everyone could have just moved on. Gary, you want to jump in on that one?
Yeah, if I can, I found it incredulous, and that's the right word. I mean, incredible, incredulous. In other words, utterly unbelievable. But the reason that takeover wasn't there to go through was because of piracy of football. Are you having a laugh? I mean, there is it just doesn't make sense. Why would they, if they really wanted to stop football clubs videos being produced, there's ways to do that. And you know that it's just I can't possibly conceive that that's the reason why the Saudi Arabian takeover of Newcastle was blocked. It beggars belief. It's so infinitesimally unimportant in the great scheme of things. I mean, here's the question: does people watching football on piracy, for want of a better description, does it cost the Premier League a penny? I think the answer is no. I mean, I'd be interested to see. I mean, you know, okay, you could say, well, some people go to the game if they weren't watching on TV. I don't think that's true, personally. It's an arguable point. I don't think that's true. You would deny more people access to watch the games. But I just can't. It just doesn't make sense. It just makes sense. How can that be true? How can that be the real reason that didn't let that that takeover go ahead?
Yeah, I mean, maybe there's a lot more to it, but a lot of what the legal documentation they required and seemed to be holding out for a long time was about the state influence in the bid, and therefore also the state influence in the company that was pirating the Qatari TV deal, and it was to make sure there was a sufficient separation there. And human rights never seemed to get a mention other than by people complaining about it. It was certainly never part of any of the publicised views or conversations between Premier League, the club, and the buyers.
I'm sure you're right, Aidan. I'm sure it was in the papers, but it was only in the papers because somebody put it there. I mean, I can't. Why would they make that distinction? I mean, you could say, well, okay, it's because there were links between this Qatari-based organisation. Where, but is that a good enough reason? Because if you're going to say the right and proper things, there are so many, you know, and you know, Roma would fall foul of a lot of right and proper judgments, and so would so many other club owners in so many different divisions of English football. I can't. It just doesn't make sense. It just doesn't make sense. You know, and Stephen made a really good point earlier about, you know, saying about, you know, the Man City ownership. But I'm not going to sort of criticise anybody else's ownership. But there are lots of sport washing allegations about money there and human rights and such like. far more important than, and human rights in, you know, in Saudi Arabia as well, far more important than tuppenny halfpenny issue like football, video piracy. It's just, I'm sorry, I'm not having it.
Well, there are still things afoot in all this, you know, that there are various legal moves going on about getting the actual evidence for why it was blocked, even if it was unofficially blocked, and whatever else. Mike Ashley hasn't given up. He certainly wants to sell, which, you know, for once, we can't actually blame Mike Ashley for any of this, but which is quite a novel thing for us in Newcastle. I mean, Lewis, come to you on this theme. Can any good come from the endless search for ever wealthier owners? It seems each time it's going up a notch. I don't know where we go next from Emirati powers, Saudi powers, and so on. I don't know what becomes the next wealthiest if Google or Microsoft take over a club or what. Is it simply a constant search for more cash, or can anything good come from it?
I mean, the only positive I can find from it, if we keep sort of ascending the amount of questionable owners who own some of the biggest football clubs in the world, it's so obvious that for some owners, and I don't want to say anyone in particular, but it does come out of greed and entitlement. But at least with the Newcastle takeover, which I don't agree with how it was handled, I absolutely agree. I think it's kind of, quite frankly, disgusting that the most important issue for them is parity rights. Totally agreed with Gary on that. But at least that has, for a brief period of time, opened up a conversation about who owns and funds football clubs, and football in a wider sense in terms of the TV rights and stuff. But I don't feel like I've ever really heard people talking about the ownership of football clubs to the scrutiny of City, and then more so the failed takeover deal in Newcastle. And I think that's at least a positive step in, as I say, having that conversation about who owns and funds football. But if we're being totally realistic, some people didn't know want that to happen because of the human rights violations or the damage just to the game. They did it because they don't want that top six bracket to be. They want that top six to stay as it is, which is quite. Newcastle would have breached that almost undoubtedly if they'd had the takeover. But sort of the thing with that is that the top six hasn't been the same top six. If you look back 10, 20 years ago, would Spurs have been in there? Probably not. Would Manchester City have been in there? Definitely not. So it's definitely something to consider. And at least we're starting to have conversations about it, but I think we're a long way off any real change.
Well, this leads us nicely onto Project Big Picture, I think, Lewis, because this was driven by the Premier League's American owners, I think, Man United and Liverpool. In particular, and one of the main drivers seemed to be consolidating the power of the top few. You know, they wanted to change the voting rights and things like that to make sure that the smaller clubs of the Premier League couldn't hold sway over them when it came to decisions. I guess, firstly, I come to you, Stephen, on this one. Is this a sign of some owners perhaps either seeking to eliminate competition, as Lewis is highlighting a little bit there, or is it even, as we mentioned a little bit previously, the ultimate aim possibly to pull up the drawbridge altogether, maybe a future of a more American-style approach, possibly pan-European rather than English, but, you know, is that the ultimate end goal here?
I think that's exactly where it's going, or it was certainly the objectives of the power grab, which were just disgraceful to use the coronavirus situation for that power grab. It just proved that, you know, they hadn't thought that up overnight. It's clearly being discussed in, you know, smoky back rooms somewhere. Is this pulling up of the drawbridge, as you say, the American style, as Lewis was muting to earlier. This American style of no promotion, no relegation, you know, you're and using them as franchises that are there to stay with no danger coming. It's a very interesting point about the Newcastle one. I can imagine that there were some worried owners at the top six clubs, knowing that that influx of money could come into Newcastle, because that would have undoubtedly put them as major players. the one that wanted that. So yeah, I do think that there's very much a pull the ladder up attitude to them that have got their feet under the table at the big six clubs. What that means for the rest, you just don't know. It really is. I just think I can see it being a European Super League. I think that's the only way it works where they would actually get it through, because the EFL would have to be involved in the discussions, the Premier League would have to be involved in the discussions, and UEFA would, and FIFA would. And we all know what happens when it gets as high as FIFA and there's money swishing around. I do think that we're probably, it could still be a decade or two away, but I do think we'll end up with a European Super League. And I do think that will be pushed and pushed by the core of American owners. I think that's the ultimate objective for them, yeah.
And Gary, as a fan of a club that is in the current Big Six, so I'm, Chelsea haven't always been there, but I guess for the last couple of decades, they certainly have. How do you view that, the big picture suggestions and the way that, that sort of came across and came about?
Disgraceful, absolute disgrace. You know, it would kill football. I guess, you know, without the possibility of clubs breaking through, Chelsea wouldn't be where they are now. Man City wouldn't be where they are now. Even Liverpool wouldn't be where they are now, because that you know, the it's a really strange thing. You know, you never notice change when you're going through it. It's only in the rear view mirror that you can see how things have changed. And if you look back, I don't know, 10 years, perhaps not 10 years, well, a dozen, 15 years, Man United were a top club, and nobody could see Man United not being a top club. Nobody, pick 1,000 football fans, and the year before Leicester won the league, how many people would have said, I'll tell you what, I fancy Leicester to win the league this year. And if anybody says they said that, I'll be staggered, unless they're lying or joking. So I think one of the important things about football is the unpredictability of it. And if we take that away, we're in trouble. With regard to the European Super League, you know, I can see it happening, but if it does, I think it'll die within 5 years. And I'll tell you the reason why. So let's imagine, I don't know how it's put together. I did see some figures where it'd be 4 clubs from England, 4 from Spain, 4 from Italy, Germany, 2 from Germany, 2 from France, or whatever. But by definition, those clubs who are going to be going to the Super League are the clubs who are used to winning that league, their individual leagues, you know, every 3 or 4 years. So Real Madrid, Barcelona, they're used to winning. Juve, I mean, they've had a bit of a monopoly the last few years, but perhaps, you know, the Milan clubs, Lazio perhaps, or Roma, certainly in England, you know, Liverpool, Man City, Chelsea, perhaps Tottenham, I don't know, whoever. But in a league, there's only one club can win that league. And everybody else is going to lose. Now, if you're second or third in a league of 20 top European clubs, you're going to think, okay, that's going to be... But when you're sort of... And somebody's going to be bottom. Somebody's going to be bottom. Somebody's going to be the bottom three. Somebody's going to get tanked almost every other week and be adrift. And that club then is going to look less attractive for players to come and join them. It's going to be less attractive for fans. And less people are going to want to buy the subscriptions, which are inevitably going to be charged, to watch that club in that country. And you'll just have the same situation occurring again. You can't have 20 clubs winning a 20-club league. It just doesn't make sense. It's impossible. So I just can't see how it's sustainable in the longer term. And they're talking, you know, UEFA are talking now about this, it's going to happen, this, I don't know what you call it, Europa League Division 2 or whatever. I mean, I just can't understand how the financial plan will work. I mean, no disrespect to the club, so forgive me, I'm just going to plug names out of thin air. Who's going to pay a subscription to watch Górnik Zabrze play AZ Alkmaar? I just can't see it happening. It just seems unsustainable. And I was on a pod a while ago, and one of the guys, I can't remember who it was, said, you know, it's you for doing something for the fans. Are you having a giraffe? You for don't do anything for fans. You for do things for the money. So I can't see a European... Well, if it happens, I just can't see. It's unsustainable. But certainly, big picture, absolute disgrace. If you haven't got a pyramid where clubs can prosper and go down the other way as well, It's going to stagnate and it's going to lose all competitiveness. Sorry, rant over, Aidan. Sorry, mate.
All good.
I absolutely agree with everything you just said there, Gary. What you just reminded me of is when you said that they're almost wanting to take away the unpredictability of football, which is what we all love about it, the true underdog story, and the fact that in a game of football, more than any other sport, historically, anybody can beat anybody. You know, there's no great sort of physical advantage that you might have in some sports. And what they, I think the current thing that's affecting the enjoyment of the fan most, especially the fans watching on TV, is obviously VAR. And I just believe that that is also been developed because the financial impact of a bad refereeing decision on some clubs, especially those top six clubs, if one of them missed out on Champions League qualification or missed out on winning the title, it's just too big of a risk for them. So that I think that's why VAR has been so much pushed over the line and pushed down our throats. When it clearly doesn't work, it's absolutely stunted the fluidity of the other game. I can admit I was wrong. I thought it should come in, and it's just been a resounding failure. A friend of mine who is actually a professional has been desires the championship. We had long debates about it. He always said this would happen. He always said it would stunt it too much and it'd have a very negative impact for the viewer. And it has done. And when you think who actually gains out of that, who gains from taking away that unpredictable edge, those bad refereeing decisions, or the very, very tight offside line call, the handball rule, which has had to be redefined because under super slow-mo conditions, you can't actually make your mind up really what's handball and what isn't, if it's deliberate, if it's not. So, again, I just think that's yet another bit of the joy of football chipped away at for the financial stakes.
Gary, come back in there.
Yeah, just very quick there, to pick up on the VAR situation. I also wanted VAR to come in, and I think the principle is still right. I think the problem is the execution in the UK. In Spain, it's much better. It's done much better. Right. There's less delay, and you know the referees have more control rather than just being told through the rear roll what they're going to say. I think the thing is with VAR, it's almost the principle situation. And there's no right or wrong answer. If some people want VAR, it's fine. But don't want VAR, that's also fine. But I would say to people who say, let's chuck VAR out, is don't moan if you get a handball decision against you that it's clearly a mistake. Don't moan then. Now, I'm not saying Stephen would do, but I know lots of people who sort of, say, oh, VAR's great when it works for them, but not so much when it doesn't. If VAR makes mistakes less often, to me, it's a good thing. Now, it needs to find, it's not perfect, it's nowhere near perfect. But, you know, having less mistakes, to me, in my mind, is better than having more mistakes. And, you know, as I say, it's a perfectly reasonable stance to say, I don't want VAR, let's take it out. That's fine. Don't moan about mistakes afterwards.
I would moan, but I feel like...
No, I wasn't talking about you, Stephen. I wasn't talking about you, mate.
No, but that's what I'm saying. I think that it's almost taken away that that passion for the mistake, if you know what I mean. We sure. Loved deep down, I think we loved to moan and feel like we'd been robbed if this team had lost. You almost enjoyed that that sense of we was robbed on the day, we fought the good fight. So it's kind of taken that away as well. I'm still, like I say, I was an advocate for it before it came in. I'm now wishing it hadn't in its current form, particularly in the English game. But I'm not against something of, you know, a format that works better.
Yeah. Your stance is perfectly reasonable, Stephen. As I said, you know, if you like the glorious unpredictability of the game when things go, that's part of the game, and that's absolutely fine. You know, if people want that, that's fine. No criticism at all.
Well, such discussions are all quite a far cry from how the game was even 20, 25 years ago, aren't they? I mean, to me, I think the first change in my mind came, I remember just thinking back on this recently, I was watching an FA Cup tie on TV, which must have been around 2000, 2002, something like that. And it used to be, obviously, the FA Cup was the biggest trophy in the domestic game, of course. But in this case, the stadium, it was of a large Premier League team. It was half empty, as if nobody cared anymore. I remember feeling, And at the time, I felt a little bit shocked, but maybe I was a bit late on the uptake of this from what the general perception was. But time has shown that this was, I guess, the beginning of a slide towards a level of apathy when it comes to the cups, which now seems so ingrained. Clubs seem to follow this by many cases, not even attempting to win the cups. My own club had a stated policy for a number of years under Mike Astley that we just simply wouldn't try to win cups. All that they wanted to do was avoid getting relegated. So the thing is that's kind of the moment where it changed for me. It kind of opened my eyes to where things were going a little bit wrong. So my question to each of you is, when did it change for you? So Lewis, I'll come to you first on that one.
I think for me, it's an odd one. As someone who's Scottish, I think, and to take our Premier League away from it a bit, I think the Scottish Cup means a lot more in Scotland than the FA Cup means in England. So from the FA Cup used to be an all-day event back when football wasn't quite as viewable. We didn't have, as Gary said, we didn't have free UEFA competitions to be watching on one subscription followed by every Premier League game. Football wasn't something you could watch as frequently as you can. So the FA Cup was quite a special thing. And I think that's, it's almost lost that a little bit in England. And you can blame that on the way it's been presented in the media, or you can blame it by the more football that's on show. That's sort of completely up to yourself. But I just think it's done almost the right way in Scotland. Like, there's just more importance to the Scottish Cup. But it just seems like in England, there's just not that same impotence, that same importance. You look at the almost apathy there is to Mikel Arteta, who, and I'm not excusing some of the questionable football they played this season, Arsenal, but he won the FA Cup, the last FA Cup, and there's almost no almost respect put on his name as a result of that. And I think that kind of speaks volumes as to where the FA Cup sits in the minds of football fans at the moment.
Well, in terms of the game in general as well, I mean, Stephen, to you, when did it change in perception, I guess, for you, from when the game that you used to know and love changed into the financial behemoth or the soulless vacuum, as you so well described it earlier? Is there a particular moment that it altered for you?
I have thought about this recently. I do think that there was various moments that were leading up to it, and the scales were getting closer as the fan involvement and the fan interaction was getting taken further and further away from the game, and the men in suits were more and more dictating what the game would look like on the field. I think Manchester United's decision not to play in the FA Cup after winning the treble was a key one in terms of what we've just discussed about the FA Cup suddenly getting devalued. And I think that hit the fans hard. I really do. Obviously, if you go further back than that, the Premier League inception was when the first massive influx of TV money came. But that was a joyous, for at least a decade, that was a joyous thing. As I say, we got TV coverage that we'd never had before. We got pundits that we'd never had before. We got sort of slow motion replays, and there were more money in the game. Referees became professional. They drove out the scourge of the 80s, which were the hooliganism and the racism. And I just personally feel like the 90s almost hit this peak. As I say, the flair of the foreigners that they did bring in was just fantastic to see. You had Ruud Gullit and Faustino Asprilla and these kind of players. It was just a wonderful moment for me in football. And then as we went past the millennium, Manchester United made that decision not to play in the FA Cup. And then we had the Abramovich takeover. I think that's when the scale started to really balance out. I think that's not to blame the Abramovich takeover. I think that was more symptomatic of the time. We lost Leeds. Leeds had overstretched financially massively. They were spending fortunes on players and wages far outside the budget to try and keep up with the money that had come into the big clubs. And then we lost Leeds out of the Premier League, which I do think were a big loss for a long time. Everybody liked to beat Leeds. And then after Abramovich came in, that changed a lot of the money-wise. It certainly shifted towards the player, I think, then the player becomes so much more powerful, because that is where the money ends up eventually. On top of the players getting more powerful, we started seeing super agents coming in, these vultures that were just taking the money out of the game, rinsing the game. 2006, I think, the Kia Gerard Japan, Carlos Tevez, Javier Mascherano at West Ham, which led to them staying up, Sheffield United going down. I think that's when we really, at that point, we could blatantly see that money was controlling the sport at that point. So, yeah, it certainly happened by then. And then as we've gone further down the line, the agents have taken further over. Players now are, young players are rich young men with mansions and flash cars before they've even had a first team game. That has to affect their hunger at some of them. It has to have done. You've got the likes of Mesut Ozil sat on the bench earning £350,000 a week, seemingly without a care in the world, seemingly doing it at the purposeful disdain to the fans, almost rubbing it in the face sometimes, it seems to me. I think it's an absolute disgrace. Would we have seen that 20 years ago? Absolutely not. No way. I don't. It just wouldn't have happened. So, I think that it was around just after the turn of the millennium, as I say, I think many are dropping out of the FA Cup, Abramovich takeover, losing Leeds, super agents, that sort of timeline over that few years is where it happened for me.
And how about you, Gary?
It's interesting, the guys, you know, talking, you mentioned earlier about, you know, the different generations we've got amongst us. You know, first time I remember the game change was 1966 when England won the World Cup, and football changed then. And it's changed a number of times since, and certainly the Premier League, the advent of the Premier League is probably the most significant. But, you know, introduction of goal line technology, VAR, as we touched on earlier, clubs being owned by states, clubs being owned by oligarchs, clubs being owned by people who were just buying a club to make money rather than to sort of to support the local community, whatever. So the game has gone through so many changes, and I think, you know, the only thing that we can be sure about is that it'll go through some more, for good or ill. I think that's just inevitable. I'll touch brief on the FA Cup, because I wanted to sort of talk about that when we come to our sort of soapbox things. But, you know, people say the FA Cup's been devalued and top clubs don't take it seriously anymore. And there's some truth in that, with teams putting out weakened teams, I should say. And I think it's important that, you know, we recognise the reality of the situation. So here's a list of teams, a list of clubs that have won the FA Cup since the Premier League started. Manchester United, Tottenham, Liverpool, Arsenal, Manchester United, Everton, Manchester United, Chelsea, Arsenal, Manchester United, Chelsea and Liverpool, Arsenal, Man United, Arsenal, Liverpool, Chelsea, Portsmouth, Chelsea, Man City, Chelsea, Wigan, Arsenal, Man United, Arsenal, Chelsea, Man City, Arsenal. Now, if you take Wigan and Portsmouth as being the unusual ones in there, because they are, in that 30-year spread there, the top clubs have still won the FA Cup. So it's difficult to sustain an argument that clubs don't take the FA Cup seriously.
Indeed so. Well, that's a lengthy discussion on the modern game. I think we'll a bit of a time for a change of topic now. We've got through quite a bit there. But a chance now for our guests to pick up any other subject they want to, step up on their soapbox and tell us about any football theme of their choice, a rant or something to warm the heart with positivity. I think, Lewis, coming to you first, this is more of a rant than something to warm the heart with positivity, I think, given events you want to pick up on this weekend.
Well, yeah, you've definitely hit the nail on the head there. Definitely not a positive moment, that's for sure. So, obviously, this was the first weekend for the longest time we had fans back in stadiums, albeit 2,000 for certain clubs. But that's quite a momentous thing nonetheless, and should have been a really powerful, positive thing, almost a football getting, and in quotation marks, back to normal as much as it can. But instead, what we had at the Millwall versus Derby game was Millwall fans jeering their players and the Derby players alike as they took the knee in support of the Black Lives Matter movement. And, I mean, I just found this absolutely heartbreaking at the time. I didn't watch the game live, but I've obviously seen that clip. And People have alleged that it's happened at other games, but I'm not 100% sure on that. I've not seen the footage of that myself, so I don't want to speculate. But I've absolutely seen the footage from that, and it did happen, unfortunately. And I just think it's... I just find it absolutely ridiculous because, like, the Black Lives Matter movement, it isn't partisan. It's not this political movement that I've seen some people try and justify the jeering as. It's a human rights issue, and there's nothing more to it than that. It's as simple as that. It's a human rights issue. It's not really up to, in my opinion, it's not up to debate at all as to whether it's an important issue that footballers and everyone else in society should continue to be advocating for. And for those who tried to defend it in terms of saying, oh, but this movement's gone on long enough, players have been kneeling for a long time, we, in quotes, get the message, or we've got to kick it out for that, there's a no room for racism campaign. But it's not enough. And I'm afraid just saying pledges like that and saying we've got these little things that subsidise the issue, it's a mask of inclusion. It neglects real change, which is what needs to happen here. So for the people who think that it's gone on long enough and what the Millwall fans there did was okay, and that, for example, Colin Kazim Richards was wrong to stand up and oppose them, I find it absolutely ludicrous, and all power to everyone who continues to support the movement.
Yeah, I mean, it was such pent-up anger. It's quite incredible that, you know, the first thing you think of doing on the first time you're allowed back into a match for 9 months or so is such vitriol coming out. And the club, to their credit, have condemned it straight away, as have various players and so on. But yeah, it was very saddening to see and hear, wasn't it? But a sad reality, unfortunately. Stephen, coming to you next. What have you got for us?
I picked up last week, I think it was last week, when it was announced that Marcelo Bielsa had been shortlisted for the FIFA Manager or Coach of the Year Award, World Coach of the Year Award. And yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan of Bielsa. His style of play, fantastic. His attitude towards the game, his ability to get the best out of players. I mean, look what he's doing with Patrick Bamford in the Premier League now. It's amazing. But in terms of an achievement, a nomination, it just really did smack of this football snobbery that goes around, and this sort of a little closed shop, which I think Bielsa is almost like the headmaster of, if you like, because he brought about so many of the changes and inspired so many of the other managers that that have sort of got themselves within this closed shop. I think it's like an Iberian thing that we've got a bit of an obsession since the tiki-taka era and Spain winning everything and Barcelona winning everything under Pep. And it just gives rise to the old Sam Allardyce quote, you know, if my name was Sam Allardyce, I'd have got the Real Madrid job or whatever it was. It really does start to make you wonder about that. I mean, Chris Wilde took Sheffield United from League One, also runs to put knocking on the door of Europe last year. There was no such recognition for that. His name wouldn't have even appeared across the dashboard, I don't think. He just wouldn't. I do think that there's this football snobbery, especially regards to tactics, especially regards to, like I said, I think it's like an Iberian influence, a South American influence, especially that we seem to have this natural adoration to. It's just other managers must really get frustrated at that. And I think especially now when you see the game, you see so many, it seems to have trundled down the leagues, players who are uncomfortable on the ball, they've worked hard to get themselves as professional footballers playing centre-half, and all of a sudden they're almost ridiculed if they're the sort of centre-half who puts the laces behind the ball and gets it up the right end of the field. They've now been told that they've got to play out from the back. And we see it week in, week out. You might see it in the top division, you might see it in a lower league. Players looking foolish, getting caught in possession, goalkeepers looking foolish. I just think we need to stop this love affair that we've got with that style of play, or this almost bullying insistence that that is how the game's got to be played now. I mean, Pep Guardiola still would be the first name on everybody's lips if you said, who do you think the greatest coach in the world is? I personally think it's been underachieving for many years now. I mean, he hasn't won the Champions League for 10 years, despite always being one of the top sort of four or five clubs in with a chance of winning it every single year. He hasn't even come close, really. I don't think he's got to a final in all that time with either Bayern Munich or Manchester City. But yet, because he's willing to put Kyle Walker into midfield, or it was Philip Lahm who did it originally, you know, it's this visionary, it's this, let's be honest, football's about winning games, football's about getting results. And yeah, I do think, firstly, I think if you do put Sam Allardyce in charge of Man City and give him all the money that Pep spent on fullbacks, I do think he'd have probably won as much as Pep. But we've just got this current obsession with that style of play and a certain look of a manager, a feel of a manager that we just view as fashionable. And yeah, I get frustrated on behalf of other fans, like say Chris Wilder's one that really springs to mind. I know they're struggling at the minute, but what he did over that few seasons was remarkable. Never got linked with sort of an England job or a bigger job. Never got sort of any real recognition. But Marcelo Bielsa takes Leeds with the biggest budget in the Championship, biggest fan base in the Championship, gets them promoted and is on this absolute stellar list of nominees for the biggest coaching award in the world. I think it just smacks of a little bit of hypocrisy.
Well, I think you've got a fair point there, Stephen. I mean, Lewis has mentioned in the chat there, I won't take credit for this. He's mentioning Jorge Jesus at Flamengo. He was probably one that didn't get thought of because he's not in Europe at the top of the Champions League and so on with a big reputation there. It's, you know, they could cast the net further afield in people who've performed well in lesser leagues as well. If you wanted to sort of consider good management, I'm sure there's plenty of examples, but yeah, great point. And Gary, coming to you. What have you got?
Well, I mean, just I wanted to talk about the FA Cup. We sort of touched it earlier, but I just want to sort of flag up this. There's still a magic of the FA Cup there, and you know, one of the ties I'm looking forward to is Marine being drawn against Tottenham. It's Marine against Mourinho, which I think is a nice little headline. And it's going to be interesting because you know, there's no advantage now. I mean, you see often smaller clubs changing the. For going the home advantage, you go into the bigger ground to get more money. It's not point. No, there's going to be no fans there anyway, so it doesn't really matter. So I just know there's a little bit of a potential. I mean, if ever Marine get a great result against Tottenham, that'd be fantastic. But what I wanted to talk about was Elche. The time before we were on, I was saying about when Elche got promoted, the crazy roller coaster they got to get promoted, and then. Two or three weeks before the season, new season started, the manager left and they sold all the players. And it looked like they were going to be a disaster. But they appointed a new manager. They signed five new players. And they got a draw today with, I think, Villarreal. I'm not sure if Villarreal or Valencia. And they're exactly halfway in the league, level on points with Barcelona. And I just think that's a fantastic story of a club doing things in a different way. And, you know, going back to discussion, you know, Stephen was mentioned earlier about unpredictability. This is a club nobody saw get promoted. 2 years, 3 years ago, I'll tell a lie, they were in the third tier, got promoted, got stabilised, got promoted again, and they're halfway up in the league. So, you know, unpredictability of football is a great thing. Let's keep it, let's celebrate it, because it's bloody important in red football.
Absolutely, well said. Well, there's plenty of other stuff going on at These Football Times as usual. Our latest magazine on PSV Eindhoven was landing on doorsteps recently. And do have a listen to the podcast we recorded a little while ago on PSV if you haven't already. Our next magazine's in the works at the moment too, which will be coming along soon. Plus, of course, the not-so-secret Maradona mag is underway as well. Plenty more on the podcast front. As well, there's a terrific one recently with Stephen here on his Chapecoense book. And I've got to say, Stephen, your passion for the subject and the story came through in spades in that podcast on a subject that, as you say, and it needed to be told. So everyone, really do give that one a listen. I guarantee you'll be wanting to buy the book and give it a good read after that. It was a terrific part and a great subject to get into if a tragic one, of course. And plenty of great online writing too, so to round things off as usual, I'll get each guest to flag up a recent article from the website that they particularly liked. For myself, I've gone for The Final Days of Football in the GDR by Konstantin Ekner. It's a particular era in history that appeals to me. There's a certain allure about Eastern Europe and GDR in particular, and football in the GDR. It's just a window into that world. It's so sort of unknown and unusual. It's fascinating. So this piece focuses on the final days, of course, of the GDR and how that impacted on the football clubs and the players as they sought new opportunities or, in some cases, struggled to come to terms with their new reality. So I find that one a particularly interesting piece. Lewis, come to you next. What have you picked for us this time?
So I've picked an article by Rich Lavery, which is Germany legend Anja Mittag talks an incredible international record, penalty pressure, and RB Leipzig's future. And I thought this was quite a nice sort of coup for the website in terms of getting an exclusive interview with absolutely fine female footballer in terms of the fact she's won a World Cup. And just from reading it, as someone who wasn't too familiar with her career, I found it very interesting hearing about both her career as a player, and she's now stepped, she was previously a player coach of Red Bull Leipzig, I believe now she's just coach, and it just takes a really interesting look from both perspectives, especially with her full-time role at Leipzig, who as a club are up and coming in the women's game, as opposed to their sort of men's equivalent, which obviously had a very rapid emergence in the past few years. So I think that's a really interesting article that people ought to read.
Excellent. And Stephen, how about you?
Yeah, thanks, Adam. The one I've chosen is actually the one that's re-emerged. That's I think it's about 4 years old. It's from Stephen Scraggle, who's by far the most eloquent Scouser I've ever dealt with, and I love his writing. He was clearly shown to be well ahead of his time when writing about the Under God goal, which has obviously become topical again after recent events, and probably going to retrace the steps a little bit here, but what it talks about is how the British media over the years have sort of completely overshadowed everything else that happened in that game. The fact that he was targeted for a lot of physical abuse, the fact that he was completely unplayable at that time. England went into that game almost accepting that he was unplayable at that time. And the fact that actually the Under God goal is actually a beautiful and perfectly executed piece of skill in its own right. Obviously, it was an illegal move that should have been spotted by somebody, but the fact it wasn't, the fact he did it with such sleight of hand, running at full pace after a move that he'd started himself. And the piece by Stephen is almost an homage to the goal, which I think almost 5 years ago, that would have been the first ever heard of that, let alone read a full detailed article about it. Now, after his death, especially after those disgraceful red top headlines the day after his death, it seems like the football world has caught up to that view now, that Maradona was actually just doing what he needed to do to drag his country to the semi-final of the World Cup, which they obviously went on to win with him dragging him there almost single-handedly. He obviously scored the amazing goal, possibly the best goal of all time, in the same game. I just thought it showed how ahead of the time that Stephen and the Football Times were with that article almost 5 years ago now.
That's brilliant. It's one of a number, I guess, that's resurfaced in recent weeks, hasn't it, on that theme. And Stephen, I think, will absolutely love what you said about it, and also the fact that you described him as the most eloquent Scouser you've ever dealt with. I'm sure he'll like that one. Anyway, Gary, coming to you next.
Okay, but before I start, can I just say that, and I meant to say earlier, listening to what Lewis said about the incident of Millwall, 100% agree, absolutely abhorrent behaviour. And I've got a few friends who are Millwall fans, and they agree with that entirely as well. Embarrassment. I'd also echo your point about Stephen's book. It talks about a story that needs to be told. That's the story that needs to be told, and Stephen does it with such empathy as well. So that's a fantastic read. I recommend his book to anybody if you're interested in football. It's a great read. The article I picked is one by Billy Monday, looking at Joaquin, the Real Betis player, a real legend in Sevilla for the Betiscos. fans. This is a guy who's now 39 and started off with a club and got sort of seduced to go to a big club, but came back to his first love. And he invested over €1 million of his own money in buying shares at the club. He's now the fourth highest shareholder at the club. I mean, talk about commitment to a club. And today, I'd say he's 39, he's 40, I think, in June or July next year. And don't bet a bit against this guy who's still been playing in the top level next year. He came off the bench today with 8 minutes to play and his team losing 2-1. 3 minutes later, he created the equaliser for Miranda. So, you know, it's talk about a legend. And Billy's article is really good, so I'd recommend it to anybody to read about a guy who is utterly committed to his club. You know, we know the old story about, you know, I was so impressed I bought the company. Well, this guy's so impressed he almost bought the Parish Young Club.
Excellent. Okay, we'll wrap up there for today. All that remains is to thank my guests for making it such a great discussion as always. Stephen, great today's Football Times debut for you. I hope the chat about the soulless modern game has been cathartic for you.
Yes, I'll sleep better having got that off my chest. Thank you, Aidan.
Good stuff. And Lewis, thanks to you too.
Thanks again for having me.
Perfect, as always. And Gary, thanks to you as well. Another weighty topic to get into.
Yeah, you can't be talking about football with your mates, have a glass of wine on a Sunday evening.
Thanks to all our listeners, of course. And please join us again next month for another big discussion. And we'll catch you all next time. Cheers and bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a Thees Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.